Moshe is immediately put off and worried about this offer of B'nai Gad or B'nai Reuven. It seems as if in the beginning it's B'nai Gad or B'nai Reuven who approach Moshe. Later they're joined by half of the tribe of Manasseh. But it seems as if the primary movers and shakers are Reuven, noble princely tribe, and you expect them to be leading this initiative, having self-confidence. As Rashi points out a bit later, Gad were warriors. That's part of what Moshe was concerned about, that they may not be able to capture the land of Israel without the military might supplied by Gad. But that's what also, as the Ramban points out, gave Gad and Reuven the security to live by themselves, with their flanks exposed and vulnerable in this wild land of wars between Moab and Sichon Melech Amori and Ammon. They trusted that Gad could support them. And when they approach Moshe, Moshe is originally shocked, and Moshe is concerned by the immorality, Hachachem b'nei Yisrael yavo l'milchama v'atem teshvu po, but is also concerned that this may be Meraglim chapter 2, they're tilting the hearts away, lama t'ni'un eslev b'nei Yisrael, ko'asru avosechem. Moshe relives the trauma of the Meraglim, spends 5 or 6 psukim describing the Meraglim, and describes the Meraglim with such a level of precision that he even describes their punishment, that they were banned from Israel, aside from two. Kalev ben Yefuna and Yoshua ben Nun ki malu acharei Hashem. And on its own, Rashi doesn't comment on why Moshe mentions Kalev and Yoshua. Moshe is very, very thorough in reliving, again, as I say, there's a trauma that Moshe lives. The Egel didn't dispatch them into a 38-year journey. The Meraglim did. So Moshe is right away identifying with the Meraglim more than the Egel. And part of that deep identification is he doesn't just relive the sinners and the criminals, but the heroes. But when he mentions Kalev, Rashi does comment, because Moshe mentions Kalev, but also tracks him. Kalev ben Yefuna, his father was Yefuna, but Kalev was a Kenizi. He came from the family of Kenaz. Now, how could he come from Yefuna as well as from the family of Kenaz? So Rashi explains that Kalev was adopted by Kenaz. At some point, presumably, Yefuna passed. So Kalev becomes adopted by a man named Kenaz. And Kalev's mother marries Kenaz. And Kenaz and Kalev's mother have another child called Asniel ben Kenaz, who then, of course, is the half-brother of Kalev. Now, why would Moshe mention Kenaz as Kalev's stepfather, specifically in this context in Parshas Matos? When Kalev is mentioned throughout the rest of the stories, particularly in Shlach, he isn't traced or tracked to Kenaz, and yet Moshe or the Torah, Moshe is speaking now, the Torah may be adding HaKenizi as a way of comment. Moshe may not have mentioned it, or Moshe himself mentioned it. Why is Kenaz such an important persona, or if not Kenaz himself, at least Osniel ben Kenaz, and by mentioning Kenaz, we're able to associate something about Osniel ben Kenaz with the story in Parshas Matos? Well, Osniel ben Kenaz stemmed from Yehuda, so there's certainly a parallel between the leadership of Yehuda and the failed leadership of Reuven. Reuven, of course, abdicates the Bechor. Yehuda ascends to the Bechor. And part of that ascent to the Bechor is living in Eretz Yisrael proper. And it's not just a birthright in theory, but that's why Esav leaves Eretz Yisrael in Parshas Vayishlach and Yaakov remains. So there is a contrast between Reuven continuing to abdicate their rights to the Bechor by abdicating their rights to live in Israel, by surrendering their rights to live in Israel. But it's not just where Otniel stemmed from, or Kenaz, his father, stemmed from, but his history. First of all, there are some parallels between Otniel, ben Kenaz, and these people from Reuven and Gad, inasmuch as they both war in Israel in order to marry women. Now, for B'nai Gad or B'nai Reuven, they have to serve as the vanguard, have to march in front of their brothers into Israel so that they can return to their families in Chutz La'aretz and Eva HaYarden. For the case of Asniel ben Kenaz, his half-brother Kalev announces in Shoftim Paragimel that whoever conquers this town called Kiryat Sefer from the Kenanim will be able to marry Kalev's daughter Achsa. And so it is. Asniel ben Kenaz rises to the challenge, conquers Kiryat Sefer, and marries Achsa, the daughter of Kalev. So there's a parallel in the story between Parshas Matos and the most famous Kenizi. Most famous Kenizi is not Kalev. Rashi has to inform us that Kalev wasn't genetically Kenizi. He was adopted by the Kenaz. But Asniel was a Kenaz member. And he, like the Bnei Gad, fight in Israel for their wives. Now, there is a difference, however, and this is possibly why there's a rub, or almost an irony, because Asniel, who's the first Shofet in Sefer Shoftim, rescues the Jewish people from a wicked king called Kushan Rishathaim, or Kushan Rishathaim. Now, where did Kushan Rishathaim reside? Where was his seat of power? He was the king of Aram Naharaim. Aram Naharaim is perilously close to Gilad and the areas that Bnei Gad, Bnei Reuven settle. And in many ways, you would have expected Bnei Gad or Bnei Reuven, had they remained loyal and affiliated with the Jews in Israel proper, they should have been involved in that war with Kushan Rishathaim. They would be the natural military encampments on the route from someone trying to invade Israel from the north. Why would you rely on a Judean, someone who came from Shevet Yehuda, Otniel, to travel all the way from Beis Lechem, all the way from the Gush, up north to fend off Kushan Rishathaim? You would expect at some point, even before Kushan Rishathaim starts to persecute the Jewish people, or once he's already established, you'd expect the northerners, the most northern Jewish population, to intervene, and they don't. And this just proves Moshe's theory that their affiliation is fraying. And you see this in Sefer Yoshua, where they erect a Mizbech because they're afraid that the people in Eber Yarden will forget, aside from the moral concerns that Moshe lodges, and aside from the demoralizing of the Jewish spirit and the Meraglim, or the resurgence of the Meraglim, just living far from the land of Israel can create rifts and lack of affiliation, in this case, lack of long-term interest. Okay, so the conditions of their residing in the East Bank were that they should march for those 14 years and conquer the land. But beside the conditions, you expect them to be loyal and participating in defending their brothers, and they didn't. And mentioning Kenaz, whether Moshe knew this Beruach HaKodesh and therefore mentions Kenaz, or whether the Torah inserts the word Kenizi when Moshe mentions Kalev ben Yefuneh, it certainly has a way of highlighting the error and the grave error of Bnei Gad Bnei Reuven. Now, in the next pasuk, Moshe describes the fact that because of the crime of the Meraglim, Vayicharaf Hashem b'Yisrael, Vayine'im b'amidbar 40 shana atom kol ador ha'osea ra b'nei Hashem. A very strange word, Vayine'im b'amidbar. Hashem made them travel. In other words, Vayotzi'im b'amidbar, Vayoshivim b'amidbar, Vayisa'im b'amidbar. If the Torah uses the word Vayine'im, nun ayin, and Rashi comments on this employment, Vayine'im v'yitalteleim, didn't just make them travel, but made them unstable. Tiltal is something which is constantly mobile without any rest. And Rashi traces the word vayinieim to the word navanud, the great curse of Cain. So I think there are two references in this Rashi. And both are lodged as almost a quiet critique of the Bnei Gad Bnei Reuven. What did Bnei Gad Bnei Reuven seek? Stability, residence, after so many years in the desert, they just wanted to settle down already. They were impatient. They didn't want to fight more wars. And part of what Moshe was describing to them, it wasn't just Israel versus not Israel, better pasture land, worse pasture land, fortified cities or non-fortified cities, is Moshe is questioning whether they have the right to such stability at this point. The desert is still, desert curse is still continuing until they enter the land of Israel, until they enter their birthright. Just because they've reached land which appears to be comfortable and stable and plush and appropriate for their cattle, Hashem's sentence of the Midbar has technically ended, but the history of a Jew, let's call it. The Midbar is just a intensification of what a Jew's history is. The Jews live a life of Navanad, and of course next week's Parsha, Parsha's Maaseh, there's clearly a double entendre. Maaseh refers to the specific encampments in the desert, but it also refers to the life of a Jew. And until we reach Eretz Yisrael, don't expect there to be permanence. Elizabeth Moshe is saying, it's not just that your requests are immoral, they're also impractical. Don't think that life in these plush green meadows will be so stable. Until you get to Israel, and until HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates that nest for Jewish sovereignty and Jewish settlement, you won't have the stability. You'll still be Vayini Aim. So Moshe uses the term to describe the desert journey, which is the exact inverse, diametrically opposed to what they were seeking. They were seeking stability, residence, becoming less mobile, and Moshe was saying, well, in the desert we were mobile, and even though the sentence has ended, that trajectory will continue till you get to Israel. And I think there's also a shout-out to Kayin, and the curse of Kayin, and the curse of traveling, and man's great fall. Remember, Kayin isn't just a fall, but Kayin is a continuation of Adam's fall. And the Jewish people returning to Eretz Yisrael trying to retrace the steps of Kain's fall and Adam's fall. We get to Eretz Yisrael, to the Beis HaMikdash, the idyllic world, which we hope to launch and could have launched, was one in which we escaped all the curses of Adam and Kain, and all the curses of Bereishis, and all the curses of a world of nature that didn't cooperate, of a kotz v'dardar, tzmiach lacha, b'zeh sefecha, tocha lachem, of a supernatural world. And they're playing with and severely compromising that option. Because for there, the price, for their comfortable malls and manicured lawns in Gilad, is in the north of the east bank of the Yarden, is they're foregoing the opportunity to reverse a more universal and overwhelming challenge of Navanad Tiyeh Baaretz. There's one other Rashi I want to comment about, and that occurs in the beginning of the Parsha, where Moshe Rabbeinu delivers the laws of Nedarim to the Rashi Amatos, and he says, Zeh Davar Asher Tziva Hashem. It's a very long Rashi. I'll just comment on the end of the Rashi. Zeh Davar, Rashi quotes the Medrash. Moshe Nisnabe B'Ko Amar Hashem. Moshe used the word, common phrase, Ko Amar Hashem. Mitzrayim Ko Amar Hashem, Kachatzos HaLayla, Niyareh B'Toch Mitzrayim. And that's pretty similar to other phrases the Nevi'im employed. Ko Amar Hashem. But the Medrash says Moshe also prophesied with a more superior and surpassing language. Mosif alei Moshe shenisnabe b'lashon ze adavar. So there are two interesting parts to this Rashi. First of all, if Moshe was superior to the other Nevi'im because he prophesied with the phrase ze adavar, why does that phrase highlighting his superiority appear here in Matos, not in other areas? I think the answer to that is pretty straightforward. This is the end of Moshe's career. There's a certain tragedy. Is being banned from Israel. There is a delegation of authority to the Rashi Amatos, as evidenced by the Nedarim. His authority is being questioned by the daughters of Tzlafchad respectfully, by Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven disrespectfully, or at least he feels. So this is just props to Moshe, reinforcing Moshe's historical or supernatural difference between Moshe and the other Nevi'im. And certainly in the light of Bilam and the comparisons between Moshe and Bilam, this has a great resonance. But what I want to speak about is, what is Zeh Davar? Why is that a superior language to Ko Amar Hashem? Every Navi uses the phrase Ko Amar Hashem, employs the phrase Ko Amar Hashem. Moshe Rabbeinu employed the phrase Zeh Davar. And I think the answer is as follows, that a Navi is called a Navi from the word Nivsfasayim. The word Nivsfasayim means to move your lips. Navi spoke. When David HaMelech wrote Shir HaShirim or Tehillim, he wrote it down. He didn't speak it. Of course, it was then chanted throughout the generations, but it wasn't a medium conveyed primarily through verbal delivery, as Nevuah was. So Nevuah represents the highest employment of speech, to be able to speak supernaturally, to speak with divine influence, to speak with divine understanding and knowledge, and to speak in ways that are foreshadowing. It's the highest achievement for a human being who's gifted with the power of speech. And every Navi delivered divinely inspired speech. But Moshe was different in that he empowered us to speak, if not through Nevuah, at the very least through Torah, and to create in Torah Shebaal Peh, Moshe Rabbeinu, the Gemara says, in Nedarim, could have kept Torah Shebaal Peh for himself. He decided he was Tovayin. He was generous. He decided to share Torah Shebaal Peh, and he gifted us with creative speech, if not prophetic creative speech, at least logical and Torah-based creative speech. And in that respect, he was superior to the other Nevi'im. The other Nevi'im delivered. Moshe Rabbeinu empowered. The other Nevi'im spoke based on HaKadosh Baruch Hu's divine intuition, divine delivery. Moshe Rabbeinu delivered his divine influence and inspiration to others, and he empowered them with the gift of speech. Zeh Davar. He didn't just say Kol Marshim, he didn't just describe Hashem's will. He delivered Zeh Davar. And that's why this phrase is mentioned in Parshas Matos. Parshas Matos describes the laws of Nedarim, the laws of Naziris, the laws of Shvuah. And it's an incredible concept that beyond the map that the Torah creates of what's Aser and what's Mutter, human beings with their speech can create real substantive changes, real binding obligations and mandates, prohibitions, through their speech. That's why the Rambam lists the laws of Nedarim and Naziris and Arachim and Charamim. He lists them in a section called Hafla, because it really is mysterious that human beings can shape the halachic landscape with their speech, but it constitutes the highest and most powerful deployment of human speech. So it's almost microcosmic or emblematic. The fact that Moshe Rabbeinu delivers the laws of Nedarim, it's really one of the last sections he delivers, highlights Moshe Rabbeinu is delivering the power of speech, and it's so ironic because he begins his career as a Arel Svasayim, as a Kavad Peh, someone that has difficulty with speech. And this is nestled right before Moshe's long speech of Eilat Dvarim Shediber Moshe. So Moshe was the quintessential speaker, and Torah transformed him into a speaker. Torah can alleviate our limitations and our flaws and can empower and amplify our latent traits. But Moshe also delivers Davar Tas. Nevi'im speak about Hashem's will, Ko Amar Hashem. Moshe Zeh Davar delivers literally the power of speech in the microcosmic sense in Parshas Matos through the laws of Nedarim, but in general, he delivers the power of Torah and the power of creative Torah, and in that respect, he's superior to the other Nevi'im who merely relayed the words of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So three interesting Rashis. One interesting Rashi about the mention of Kenaz. Another interesting Rashi about why the journey through the desert is described in terms of wandering rather than travel. Navanud, lack of stability in residence. And finally, why is Moshe's nevuah superior by that phrase, Zeh Davar, and why does it appear specifically in this context?